And he is on the phone live with us from New York. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you, Jill. How are you?
We are well here. It's a very fall-like day here in Indianapolis. What's the weather like in New York today?
I was coatless today.
Oh, we don't want to hear that. We're talking about possible snow flurries on Friday.
Well, I'm sure New York will catch up. It always does one way or the other.
It certainly does. Well, I want to talk about you a little bit before we talk about this the fabulous program that PBS is airing on Friday night. You were born and raised in Columbus, Ohio, so you're a Midwesterner as well. And I understand that both your parents, they had other jobs, but they both liked to sing. Did they sing specific songs to you as a child? Did you all kind of sing together?
Whenever there were family gatherings, we all would sing together. My father and his brothers would harmonize barbershop style, so I was exposed to this music very honestly at an early age, and it was a centerpiece of all family gatherings.
And I understand you started the piano at a very young age, too.
Yes, that was around five as well. My parents bought a new house and had the option of either buying a little furniture or buying a piano, and my father somehow persuaded my mom to agree to buying a little upright piano for $500, which was a lot of money. And for some odd reason, I sat down and started playing it by ear with both hands.
Oh, my.
And they were pretty shocked, but it was sort of, I guess, waiting to be expressed.
Were you writing your own songs and music then as you were growing up?
No, I was copying what I was hearing. Okay. I was just picking out on the piano any song that I heard, and I was pretty good at that age then, and it was kind of like a circus trick, you know?
Yes. And this would have been kind of during the 60s. So what songs were you hearing at that time that you were picking up and playing on the piano?
My parents had show albums, cast albums, so I picked out things like The Sound of Music. That's the first thing I ever played, Do, Re, Mi. First thing I ever played on the piano was Do, a deer, a female deer, with both hands. Then songs from My Fair Lady, South Pacific, those sorts of things. And some of the pop records I'd hear on the radio, I remember picking out things that were sung by Petula Clark. I mean, I was quite young, like 6, 7, 8. Then later on, when my older sister started buying like Carole King recording of James Taylor and all that, I would pick those songs out as well.
And I love how all that is going to end up circling back to you later in life. But after high school, you did what a lot of Midwestern kids did, I guess. You got out of town. You went to Los Angeles.
I did that when I was 20. First thing out of high school that I did was play in a piano bar in a restaurant in Columbus for 3 years. And eventually I decided to move to California because I'd had a very strong voice inside telling me to move there, and indeed it was the right thing to do because I met the legendary lyricist Ira Gershwin.
This is incredible. Tell everyone about this story and your relationship with him and the work with he and with his brother as well.
Ira wrote the lyrics to all the classic Gershwin songs that are part of what we now call the Great American Songbook. He was 80 years old when I met him. His brother, George Gershwin, had died in 1937 at the age of 38, and George wrote Rhapsody in Blue and Porgy and Bess, and the melodies for these classic songs like I Got Rhythm and Someone to Watch Over Me, Love Is Here to Stay. And the 6 years that I worked for Ira, starting at age 20, was my apprenticeship in learning a lot of substantive things about the songs themselves, their history, and, of course, how to interpret them.
And then, of course, from there, you take off and develop your own wonderful career. But all along, obviously from a young age, you have had this true great love for the Great American Songbook.
It's true. It wasn't called that then. It was just the music that was most often heard everywhere. And in elevators, television shows, commercials, it was ubiquitous. And it still is in a sort of devious way, and that it still insinuates itself quite often when people aren't even aware. But that music was the music that mattered most to me, and as I saw it disappearing, I became a champion of it.
Well, I think somewhere along the lines I read that you have been touted as an anthropologist of music, which is so perfect because that's the science, the definition of it, that is the science that deals with the origins, physical and cultural development, biological characteristics and social customs and beliefs of humankind. And you have definitely taken to that with those songs from the 1920s to the 50s, which are kind of the Great American Songbook songs.
I yes, I find that the Great American Songbook does not have an end cap on it, in that I feel that songs written by James Taylor, Carole King, Lennon and McCartney, I think those are also part of the songbook. I think it's ever evolving. And certainly the cap wouldn't be the 50s, because the songs of the Bergmans, and I mean, so many songs that have come since then. And that's one of the wonderful things about it, is that for me, what constitutes a song being part of what we call the Great American Songbook is that it lasts for succeeding generations. So to me, if a song is around 20 years after it was written and is getting new recordings and new interpretations, then to me it's something that will probably have a chance of lasting even longer.
And that is what your foundation is based on and centered here in Carmel at the Center for the Performing Arts. How did you choose Indianapolis?
We were looking at various places to headquarter the organization, and had offers from Las Vegas and from Manhattan and other places. But when Mayor Brainerd came to have a meeting and wanted to tell me about Carmel, of which I was not really aware, I became very quickly convinced, because of the construction of the Palladium and the larger complex, the Center for the Performing Arts and the other theaters. I saw a potential there to bring a partial identity to the center by celebrating the songbook along with all other kinds of art. And it seemed like a perfect blending, because we would have, in our collaboration, we would have staff, and we have beautiful offices and storage space, and we have room to grow, and most importantly, incredible support from the community. And it's a city, as is the Indianapolis area, very committed to keeping the arts alive and sharing it with succeeding generations. So that was also very attractive, that the arts programs in schools in Carmel are very strong.
And you do a lot of outreach in that area, too, with your foundation.
Well, the center is very much involved in that, and I'm glad to be a part of it.
Now, talking about that whole mix as well, that kind of leads us into your special on Friday night at the Rainbow Room. Wow, what an iconic place.
It is amazing. The Rainbow Room opened in the mid-1930s, and I've played there through the years, here and there, for one special event or another. But when the opportunity came up to do a special for PBS, they wanted a location that was iconic in some way, and the Rainbow Room was just on the verge of reopening after a $54 million renovation. And they allowed us to come in and film the special there, as it's the first of any activity that has happened in that new room in time for the official opening this month. And it worked out beautifully, with a 17-piece band and incredible guests. We have an incredible guest list. It's sort of an old-fashioned variety show with a lot of young artists singing classic songs.
Well, and that's kind of why, and you made that point, which I'm so glad you did, about the Great American Songbook. In the past, some critics have said it ended in the 50s or before rock and roll, but like you said, it's the ongoing songbook.
It's evolving. It is evolving.
And to be able to introduce some of these new and upcoming talents that you'll have on your PBS show, and that you have on your Song Travel show as well, too.
Well, we have, for example, Jessica Sanchez, who's 18, who was a sensational on American Idol. An amazing singer who sings mainly pop music, but she does Bacharach and David. I'm trying to remember the song. It's a classic Bacharach song, and she does it in a contemporary style. That's fantastic. Then we have the Manzari brothers, who are a very young tap team that do all kinds of tap to all different kinds of music, and they're on the show. And incidentally, Jessica appeared in our Song Hall of Fame honoring Johnny Mathis, and the Manzari brothers were part of our 2013 gala. So everybody on the show actually has appeared in Carmel in one way or another. Christine Ebersole, Cheyenne Jackson. The only person who hasn't appeared in Carmel is June Squibb, who was 83 years old and was nominated for an Oscar for the film Nebraska.
Yes.
And she does a Sophie Tucker song, and it's for me the highlight of the show. It's incredibly funny.
Well, I love the eclectic cast that you have for that show, but your show Song Travels as well. It's such a wide range of artists from, once again, all ages, all genres, and it's just a delight to hear. Do you get to select your own guests for that?
Yes, I select all the guests.
You're lucky.
Well, it's great because for me, it introduces me to music that I might not otherwise know, because we have a lot of emerging artists in every genre. We've had great country artists like Hunter Hayes, and we've had classical legends like Joshua Bell and Renee Fleming, and we've had Bette Midler and Liza Minnelli, and songwriters like Jimmy Webb. I mean, it's just been across the board, and the whole point of the show is to find the common ground of all different kinds of music, how it's all interrelated. And it's the kind of show that could only happen on NPR, so I'm very grateful for that.
Now, we've also been told that you're going to go back to the Rainbow Room for New Year's Eve. Can you give us a little sneak of that as well?
Absolutely. That show is one that will give people an alternative to watching some kind of silly countdown show. And that for both shows, we have a 17-piece band. And again, we have a variety of guests, including Leslie Odom Jr., who was on Smash, and Aaron Tveit, and Kelly O'Hara, who has this gorgeous, shimmering soprano voice. I'm blanking out because this is live radio.
Well, it's going to be, once again, a wonderful thing. What was it like to be in that Rainbow Room recording the show that's going to air on Friday night?
It was so thrilling because I felt like I was really part of the cultural fabric of New York, and it was kind of like going back in time in a certain way, but it was a contemporary extension of that. So the feeling was a little crazy. It was like feeling I was in another time, and also making music in this time. That sounds a little convoluted, but it was a duality. It was a duality of knowing that we were continuing something that really is the music of our country, and it was wonderful.
Mm. And upcoming, one of great artists coming to the Center for the Performing Arts, the Palladium, too, including Tony Bennett, is coming up in November, too. So you continue as artistic director to bring just exceptional acts to all of us here in Central Indiana.
Oh, well, thank you. Next month is Songbook Month at the Center, and that's why we have Tony Bennett on the 21st of November, and we have George Benson paying tribute to Nat Cole. And Randy Newman. And Randy
Yes.
Newman is an example of the continuation of the Great American Songbook. So we're very grateful to have the opportunity to present these artists.
Well, we are grateful to you for taking time out of your schedule to talk with us live via phone. We'll all be tuned in to PBS on Friday night, and we'll be catching more performances up at the Palladium. Continued success, Michael, and thank you once again.
Thank you so much, Jill. I enjoyed speaking to you.